Hello, bonjour, ni hao, ¿cómo estás? This is John James and welcome to Champagne Strategy. This is a red pill business podcast which deconstructs world-class strategy, focusing on growth, marketing and sales with just a sprinkling of tech and champagne. Anyone can talk about and draft strategy, but execution is increasingly where the battle is won. Connecting these phases is very challenging, and those who do it well will be at the top of their game. These people move in very tight circles and they'll have battle scars to show, skin in the game, and money in play. Learning from their practical wisdom is priceless. So it's my job to find the best people in the world and convince them to be interviewed for the benefit of all. Listen to this episode if you dare, but you've been warned, there's no going back. One of the biggest restrictions on the effectiveness of the growth function is budget. Either the person setting the budget has unrealistic expectations because they're unaware of how expensive it can be, or they are setting an overly restrictive budget which will never allow the business function to break through minimum thresholds and hit goals. Kind of like strangling your own baby. And probably the most common thing I see are executives who allocate a proportionate budget and expect disproportionate results. This flawed logic always perplexed me, considering these finance people are supposed to be rational and understand logic. But I found out later there's no cure for being cheap. It's an incurable disease. The reality is that growth is unnatural and disproportionate. Natural market forces apply negative pressure to any entity unless a positive counteracting force is applied. And this is just the natural effect of competition. More often than not, you need to apply a very, very disproportionate positive counteracting force to realize growth. The best growth and marketing people I've ever met have equally adept skills in the numbers. They know their numbers back to front, inside out. And they'll admit to areas of known risk and make that clear to everyone. They essentially have a really good working relationship with finance and the CEO, and all three work together as a very tight-knit team with shared goals and responsibility. So today we're talking to an accountant, but not just any accountant, one that works with entrepreneurs, DTC e-commerce firms, and the new wave of progressive tech companies. Even better though, he started his own business from scratch and has taken up large portions of the marketing and growth function of his own personally. So don't fear, we aren't going to be talking about accounting, but rather understanding their perspective and how finance people and accounting people think in order to do our jobs better. Because you'll probably become to realize it's harder and harder to get approval for thousands or millions of dollars of budget, which you'll claim to dedicate to a new brand fluff campaign that doesn't really have any clear objectives. So in this episode, I wanted to understand more of how an accountant sees marketing and growth. If we could understand their perspective more, we could get more things we know will work approved with an appropriate budget to match. But I was also very curious about his own growth story. What marketing and growth did he try but didn't work? What misconceptions did he have about the discipline which he later found out to be false? And what does he look at when analyzing the performance of a company? Should we be focusing, for example, on customer acquisition or CLV or profit, net profit, GMV, ROAS or ROI? All these questions and more will be answered in this week's episode. So without further ado, ladies and gentlemen, another person with two first names, Jason Andrew.
Thanks for coming on the show, Jason. How's it going?
Really well. Yeah, it's a Friday afternoon, ready for a drink. Nice. Yeah, it's been week's gone very quickly, actually, which it's always nice. Looking forward to the weekend.
Yeah, look, I haven't drunk all week, so this is the first time. And I thought, hey, it's Friday afternoon. We're both in the same time zone, which is rare. Generally, someone's trying to make me drink at like 7 a.m. in the morning if I'm having an East Coast call. So this is great. We're actually in the same city, but remote. Can you tell us what we're drinking today and what you think of it?
All right, awesome. So I've got a glass of Piper Heidsieck. Is that Heidsieck? Yeah, Heidsieck. So for those chiming in, actually, with John say in preparation for this podcast, it would be good if you had like a bottle of champagne. I'm like, well, I don't have bottles of champagne sitting around. So what he did was, actually in the neighborhood, came by my house and dropped off this wonderful bottle. So it's awesome. So looking forward to sucking into that.
Very nice. Okay, well, cheers to that, and let's have a taste, and then I'll talk about it.
And cheers, yeah.
Cheers. Cha-ching. So I think officially it's called Pieper Heidsieck. Well, that's how you'd pronounce pipe or peep in French. In fact, peep means something quite derogatory in French, which I won't go into, but it's like slang for something else. I'll let everyone Google that to find out what it means. But yeah, look, really interesting story. So let me just pull up some notes. This is the NV of this house, and this should be confused with Charles Heidsieck, which is a different house. Similar second name, obviously, but this is the NV or non-vintage. So this is sort of the cheapy version that they have. Pieper Heidsieck have vintages as well, which are a bit more expensive. But this started, it's one of the oldest houses actually, in 1777. So Florence Louis Heidsieck, who was a German guy living in France, then married a French lady, and Mary Antoinette was the first brand ambassador for this champagne. So yeah, back in 1785. Then his nephew, I think, took the last name, joined up with a French guy called Henri Guillaume Pieper. And that's where the name comes from. It's a combination of two of their names. And then, yeah, they've been going ever since. I suppose, you know, the thing I like about this champagne is it's quite approachable in terms of price. So we're talking like 45, 50, 55 AUD. So we're talking about, you know, 30, 35 USD. And what they used to do and still do a bit is they use a lot of reserve wine. So that's the old wine that they have before it's bubbly in separate tanks that they back blend in each year to the new year's harvest to give a consistent taste. Kind of like coffee blending, you know. Each year they're trying to, the beans change every year, but they need to try and get this consistent taste. So anyway, Pieper Heidsieck is very good for that, using generous portions of older wine, which gives it more depth of flavor. And for that reason, it's sort of called the Charles Heidsieck version is called, you know, poor man's Krug. But yeah, it's a very Pinot dominant blend here, very tangy, bit of depth in the background. And my champagne hack is to get these bottles, which are pretty approachable, and shove them in a cellar for a couple of years, and they'll come out tasting really, really good.
Nice.
So you can often do that with the lower end champagnes. So anyway, hope you enjoy it. What do you think?
It's delicious. Yeah. I didn't drink a lot of champagne, but it is a great, it's chilled really nicely, and it's a great Friday afternoon drink. So
perfect. Okay. Well, let's get straight into it. I suppose I've been following you for a while, and this is the backstory. And I really liked you the way you sort of told it like it is in terms of when it comes to, you know, some accounting and finance topics. And I know you mostly work with e-commerce and the retail side of things. Is that correct?
Yeah. Most a lot of our clients are in e-com. Yeah. Digital.
Yeah. Okay. But I suppose one of the biggest restrictions I see in my field of growth is this clash between, you know, the finance department and what we want to achieve. And it's sort of coming, if you can have a better discussion and have knowledge of each other's areas, you can have a lot more fruitful, I think, chances of growth when it comes to executing on these things, getting budget to execute these things in the first place. I suppose that's why I wanted to talk with you. But yeah, just a quick summary. I know you're a CA and, you know, you do a lot of work in e-com, but just a quick spiel from your side.
Yeah, so chartered accountant, been an accountant for most of my career. Founded SBO Financial, which is one of our businesses. That's basically an accounting practice where we kind of partner with fast-growing digital businesses, all of the e-commerce brands, SaaS, and like service-based businesses like creative agencies, to basically be the numbers people behind them, behind the business. So like back office accounting, bookkeeping, and then also kind of strategic kind of advice, financial modeling and capital raising and things like that. So basically the numbers nerds behind a good business is genuinely us, is what we aspire to be.
I love it because, you know, I've noticed the best growth or marketing people are people who know their numbers too and can talk to finance and are accountable to, you know, P&Ls and things like that. So I think it sort of goes part and parcel. It's a really good, you know, it's one of the first things I ask people is like, you know, show me some stats and some metrics that you've changed. And generally, you are what you measure sometimes as well. You know, that tells a lot. And then how they measure it and why really comes into the finance side of things. Because that's ultimately the goal of business, to make money and get bigger.
Exactly right.
So I think sometimes that gets lost in the marketing fluff world, you know, where people are trying to create brand awareness, whatever. But before we get into that, I suppose let's just be really specific about your story, because I think it's really interesting because you have a service business and you have grown that over the past couple of years. I've been following your story, and I think along the way you've written about it, and you mentioned that you journal every day, which is really good. But maybe just, I'm really interested in the problems you had growing, maybe some advice that you got that you thought would work that actually didn't turn out to be real. If you had some agency issues and how you got around that, like, I think that'd be really fascinating because I specialize in service businesses too. So
yeah, perfect. Accountancy is a service-based business. And I think when people think about services businesses, they think, to try scale, like everyone talks about scale because that's the fun thing to talk about, right? So you see a lot of creative agencies or digital or ad agencies, particularly in the media, talk about revenue growth and headcount and all these things. And once you understand the economics of how a services business operates, you realize that all of those things are, well, headcount definitely is vanity metrics because you can have lots of staff, and to me that's just more headache. Really, I'm more for more revenue, less people, more leverage in the business. So I guess our story is, we started the accounting firm. I was always an employee for most of my career as an accountant. Started to build my chops in the technical work, and kind of reached this crossroads where we were trying to do something a little bit different with accounting services. And kind of came this bridge. It's like, well, I had some savings that I've banked through my employment. And it's like, to start the services business, and the great thing about services business is, number one, usually low barriers to entry. Like, if you've got the skills and you can talk to people, you can generally start your business with nothing. So no CapEx, no capital requirements. But the trade-off of that is that you don't get any income until you generate the work, right? And I think the most challenging aspect of a service business, particularly growing ones, is that you are the technician. Most all the time, right? Particularly starting off, you're doing all the work, that you're actually doing the client work, you're servicing customers, you're also trying to do the marketing, the sales, the ops,
key person risk, right?
Exactly. And key person risk is fundamental in all services businesses. And I think the thing that we like to talk about is, how do you scale, how do you remove or de-risk the key person risk within the business? And easier for SaaS business or a tech startup funded, but like when you get to a certain scale, like people, your users are using the product, right? They're not using your people. They're leveraging people for customer support, things like that. But really, they're buying into the product. Same as e-commerce, they're really buying into the brand and the product that you're selling. That's where the value is. Yes, there's people behind the widgets, but fundamentally they're buying the brand. Where in people-based businesses like services business, I need a plumber. I rely on that plumber to come to my house and make sure the my pipes are fixed or the toilet's fixed. And quite often, the plumber is the key person within the business. If that person decides to go on holiday, well, they don't get paid, right? And so I think this is the real trade-off with the services business. Now, the challenge with services businesses are the economics, right? Because it's key man risk is the biggest thing that you try to manage, but also the economics of a services business, where it doesn't have that operational leverage that a SaaS or an e-commerce brand do. What I mean by operational leverage is there's a certain scale of when a company or a business grows to, where your variable, so your revenue continues to increase, but your fixed costs kind of don't grow at the same rate. They kind of plateau. If you think about like SaaS company or SaaS business models, they're hiring lots of, the startup costs are high, you're hiring developers, sales and marketing people, all that sort of stuff to build the product. But as you, find product market fit and start to scale the revenue, because you've got really high gross margins, your headcount kind of stays the same, and all the revenue there is variable revenue, and that's all bonus profit. The challenge with services businesses is that there's very limited economies of scale. So in fact, as you grow revenue, you need to grow more headcount to be able to service that revenue. And so there's only so much revenue that one person can manage because of just time and hours in the day. So the trick is trying to remove the time input to the revenue that you're generating as a services business. But and everyone likes to talk about value pricing and things like that, but it's actually very challenging to execute properly and commercially, and whilst balancing key man risk as well. Because if you load your agency up to have one employee managing $300,000 worth of revenue in an account, they get sick or they decide to go start their own business or whatever, you've got 300K hole to plug in terms of delivery. So it's a challenging business, but fun to work in.
Yeah, I find like you just mentioned some of the major, obviously I run a service business too, but I'm learning to like scale that through operational systems and processes and standardizing certain services, or like take the lower end sort of lower margin services and sort of like systemize them as much as you can. And then again, you know, maybe limit the key person risk. So introduce them to the client, the first part, have them as like more of an overseer, and then get someone else to be the main person doing the work. You know, things like that are just tactical things, but it's really hard, isn't it? Because sometimes that client really trusts you and not anybody else.
Yeah.
So it's really hard to just kind of separate yourself from. So like those are some like macro business fundamentals that are hard, but let's get into like the secrets of you growing your business. It's like somewhat successful, I would argue, or pretty successful from where you started.
Yeah, I think as I like to say, success is in the eye of the beholder. I think that sometimes we objectively look at brands or businesses and think, oh wow, they're super successful, but you know, you peel back the narrative and look at the numbers, or you speak with the founders, they're like, their version of success may be very different. So yeah, I think that in terms of like, there is no secret sauce. I think that fundamentally, a good service business is about doing good service to the community and your customers, doing great work, being authentic. And I think just showing up, like I think there's a big thing of just doing what you say you're going to do, and price accordingly. You know, there's no, we made the mistake really early on of trying to be the, you know, high volume, you know, low revs, trying to like disrupt the market, you know, with low barriers to entry type of stuff. And the reality is it may work for certain business models that aren't labor dependent, but if your key people are accountants who are typically expensive in the market, why devalue that reputation already with a lower price, and therefore limits your resourcing to attract good people to be able to do that work. So I think it's fundamentally about treating people well, finding good people to join, and really building a great culture for people to be a part of and build together. But also choosing who you want to work with as well. I think that's critical, because you can't do one without the other. And I think what we learned was you need to be very specific about who you want to work with, and be quite disciplined about saying no to work who don't fit that ideal client or that criteria. And easier said than done when you're starting up and you've got no money and you're trying to make enough income to pay the rent or the mortgage or whatever. And again, we made that same mistake. We just said yes to everything. And but over time, hopefully your business gets to a size where you can step back and really analyze your business and start to make really tough decisions, which we did. So to give you some insight, when we started first 12 to 18 months of trading, we said yes to every business. And so we had lots of different clients and different profiles of founders and different types of work. And, you know, we were growing revenue pretty quickly, but we were also growing our headcount quickly. And there was no systems, there's no standardization. And we were basically losing money at the gross profit level. And so what we did was kind of take a step back, put our accounting brain on for the first time and say, well, if I was an investor in this business, what the hell would I do? And did like a customer analysis of like, okay, who's making us money? What traits or characteristics are common for those that are good clients versus crap clients, and how do we just basically cull the rest? So we ended up culling, I think in our second year of business, we culled 50% of our client base or something like that, and just straight up said, sorry, we can't help you. Oh no, the email was, hey, reviewed our prices. Basically, it's not feasible for us to do this. Here's the options. You either pay X amount more per month for our services, which end up being like triple or quadruple the price of what they're paying, or we can refer you to a cheaper alternative and make the decision really binary, and that was it. So some people accepted the price increase, but they churned probably later. The others just disappeared, and pretty hard decision at the time, but it made sense.
So that's interesting. I mean, this is getting to like, you mentioned customer analysis here. So it's like, you know, maybe a CLV analysis or average revenue per user, well, per customer kind of analysis, and then looked at your expenses, which is obviously headcount and the time and processes of communication. And I really want to talk about that in a minute, because I think that comes into some of the metrics that are kind of, there's a lot of nuance to looking at those. But what about your acquisition strategy here to acquire new customers and grow? Really interested in, maybe you dabble with some channels and then figured out that didn't work and then switched, or you had an agency, got rid of the agency. What happened exactly there, and what sort of, I would say, misconceptions do you have in retrospect?
Yeah, it's a really great question. So we started with a strong channel partnership approach. So our approach was, at the time, SBO 1.0 purely did bookkeeping. So we started SBO to solve bookkeeping of all things. So, you know, it's low value, boring, not done well by providers, highly fragmented industry. So what we thought was, hey, let's build like a SaaS type offering of bookkeeping or a subscription. You get unlimited service, and we price based on kind of what your business does, and we'll do that. And so our partner channel was accounting firms, actually. So we're accountants, and it's like, let's sell into accounting firms who want good quality information, so it makes their life easier when they're doing tax returns. Let's make the life easier so they've got live information so they can use this, leverage this data to be more proactive with their numbers and actually have conversations with business owners about profit and cash flow and things like that. So yeah, channel partner strategy was the strategy at the beginning, and my role was literally networking with accountants. For any people who have products or services that have accountants as their customers, realize that accountants suck. Like, in terms of as customer demographics of people, man, they're horrible. I hate talking with accounting firms because they are busy. Number one, they're so busy. They're just busy trying to get the work done in front of them. A lot of them are not entrepreneurial. So for them to like take a step back and think, oh, wow, SBO or this bookkeeping thing can actually add value to my practice because of X, Y, Z reasons. It's like, yeah, that's nice in theory, but I'm too busy trying to do the work. So they're not like entrepreneurial. They don't think sometimes outside the box. Now, I'm generalizing here, but this is my experience. Or you pitch into the big four accounting firms and you realize that, you know, there's like all the partners are decision makers. There's no CEO of accounting firms. And it's actually quite rare to see in accounting practices, like because all the partners are revenue generating employees, really. They're not really business people. So, you know, stakeholder management, try and convince people to do this. This person said yes, that person's like, oh, I'm not sure, speak to the IT person. So layers of bureaucracy and really slow to act on technology or new things. And again, generalizing, but the stereotype is true. I'm an accountant myself, I can comfortably say this. And so to partner channel, worked okay. I think we still got really strong relationships with some great entrepreneurial accountants, but others it just failed. So then we were like, oh well, screw this isn't working, let's like, why don't we pitch directly to the business owners? And then that became our approach of like, I mean, they're the ultimate client, why aren't we just pitching our service to them? So did that, hired a salesperson very early in the business. We were nowhere near mature enough to have a salesperson. I wasn't paying myself at the time. I didn't pay myself for 18 months in the business, and we had, you know, four staff which are being paid more than me. And when you
see, that's high risk. Like, most small businesses don't do that. They should hire a good salesperson, but they try and do it themselves.
Yeah,
but they're not salespeople. They think they can do sales. So why did you hire that person? Because you admitted that
I'm not a salesperson. I mean, I'm an accountant, right? Like, and that's what I told myself. And I think that you quickly learn. So I hired a salesperson. It didn't work out because we didn't really have a good product. We're a compelling enough product in the market at the time. We put a lot of unrealistic pressure on the salesperson, particularly. And there's a bit of like, you see next to the guy, you're like grinding away, just trying to survive. And this guy's getting paid a base and, you know, sitting back. You know, just making a few phone calls, not really generating leads, not generating any revenue, which was the issue in the end. We're just not mature enough. So yeah, that didn't work. So like, well, shit, sales didn't work. And I realized there needs to be someone in the business that drives sales and marketing. And I just put my hand up. It's like, well, you know, who else is going to be? My business partner, Rowan, we just had a discussion. Like, I guess it will have to be me. So, and so I went down this rabbit hole of like learning how to, what is marketing, how to do marketing, what about selling and all this sort of stuff. And kind of the connotations around selling are usually negative. It's like, hey, the door-to-door salesman and blah, blah. Read a really great book, To Sell as Human. Awesome book, and basically just changed my perspective of what selling is. Got into marketing, and Seth Godin is like the legend. Went to that rabbit hole and then did his alt MBA, Seth Godin, like, yeah. Everything just, he's like Yoda of marketing, like he's legit. Where I think it's just like, he's like Gary Vee and these kind of like, not, I'm going to say shallow, they're obviously experts in their own domain, but kind of like blanket statements where like Seth is just wisdom, you know, it's just like truths and wisdom and story. Anyway, so I learned that. And then I kind of then learned through, you know, failing was that accounting services or what we do is super high trust. It's, accountants are regarded as like the doctors of business, right? It's like, hey, I've got a problem. Any problem, whether it's like I've got no money or going through a business breakup or even a divorce with my wife, like who you speak to, you speak with your financial guidance counsel. Yeah. And usually that's your accountant, your small business accountant. And so what I realized, accountants are held in that highest regard. And mate, you don't find accountants on Google. You don't go, I need an accountant. You don't search for accountants on Google. You always ask, your business community, your peers, like, hey, here's my chance, you know, a good accountant, or I need to read, I've got this particular pain point. I want to solve it. So you research it, like, oh, there's this person who creates really good content about this particular problem. You start to build trust and authority. And so it was moved into a heavy content driven approach. Whether it's called content marketing or inbound, whatever you want to call it, that's just like trying to be useful basically at scale. And I think that's the way that we describe marketing. So trying to be useful, just showing up and educating people. And that's fundamentally, what our marketing approach is now and will be into the future.
And off the back of that, obviously, you created your book, Naked Numbers.
Stark Naked Numbers, yeah.
Stark Naked Numbers, sorry, which is really awesome. So obviously, you know, a lot of the stuff that you're writing, the content, you kind of merged and repurposed into a book and added some other things. And
yeah, that book came out of, so I did the Alt MBA with Seth Godin. So for those new and unfamiliar with that, that's basically a kind of a six-week online accelerator program where you meet a bunch of people around the world. I know, I thought it would be about learning how to do marketing. It's actually not about marketing at all. It's all about like leadership and be able to ship work and just be confident in yourself. Anyway, long story short, I wrote a blog about it, which we can put in the show notes if people are interested. But one of the goals that I set within that program was to write a book on helping entrepreneurs improve their financial literacy. And that book, you know, 2.5 or 3 years later after I did that course, it was Stark Naked Numbers, which,
Wow. Great. Okay. So I love that. I mean, I find the same. I do a lot of, used to do a lot of marketing for, you know, high-end medical. So, plastic surgery, things like that. Again, very high trust. And you find out very quickly, it's all word of mouth. It's all referrals. They might suss you out on your website. They might Google a condition here or there, or like complications with surgery they had in the past. And that's kind of where you can get them in again for reconstructive surgery or whatever. But a lot of it is just, oh, where did you get your lips done? Where did you get your nose done? Exactly. You know, it's like whispered in, cafes or restaurants, you know, when the girls get together or whatever. So that's where it comes from. And for that reason, the brand is so important about the reputation anyway. So interesting. Cool. Okay. Well, look, I wanted to maybe dive a bit into accounting. And let's just answer this straight off the bat. You mentioned accountants. Like, what is an accountant? How would you describe it to someone really simply and succinctly?
Yeah, good question. So an accountant is basically, I'll explain what accounting is, right? So to me, accounting is the process of like documenting the financial story of a business, right? So that's what accountants do. It's a procedure of like getting this like unstructured financial information, like your receipts, your invoices, your bank accounts, your cash, and I put it structured into a format that helps with helping people understand that information to see if you're making money or most commonly to file your taxes. So that's what accounting is. I kind of call it like the profession of getting things in order, because that's basically what accountants do. They just like kind of get all this stuff, the business stuff, put it together and into a format, which is hopefully, can be interpreted by someone, whoever that be.
Okay, great. And I know you've written about this before. Accountants aren't bookkeepers and bookkeepers aren't accountants, or, you know, finance people aren't this. What isn't accounting? What does it get confused with?
Yeah, I think that, there's three categories, right? There's like, what's a bookkeeper, what's an accountant, and what's like finance or whatever. And I think that the accountant and the finance often get blended together, which I'll get to in a second. So bookkeeper, you know, it's literally, you know, again, stereotyping, but it's a person that like gets the data in order into a system, right? So it's the person that gets the invoices, puts it into the system, matches against your bank account, all that sort of stuff. So it's the processing of data is the bookkeeper. The accountant typically then gets that data, turns into a new format, and then files the tax return with the tax office. That's typically what small business accountants do. And then there's like the realm of finance. So I think the common misinterpretation of particularly small business owners is that they expect their accountant who does the taxes to be finance people. And so if I just explain the difference of finance, so accounting is like the past and the present, right? It's like, I've got this information, I report it, here's your report, here's what your business did, right? So that's what accountants do. Mm-hmm. Finance, on the other hand, is like, okay, I've got this information, what does it mean? And how does that, what can I do about this? Or how does it change? What decision is it going to help me make? And what outcome do I want? And so finance, in how I see things, is very much forward looking. It's like, I've got this info. How do I do some forecasting? Does it change? How's it influenced the strategic direction of our company or our business or what we're doing? what returns are we expecting based on this new information, all that sort of stuff. Where accounting is like, hey, here's the info, here's what happened, see you later. So there's two different things. I think that when most small businesses and even startup founders kind of speak with their accountants, they're looking for the unicorn. They're like, hey, I want someone that can do the tax. I need you to be across my forecast. I want to talk strategy. And the truth is that like you can never find that one person. Like we don't do tax. Like I don't do tax. We have a tax division, but like it's like a marketer, right? Like I want marketing services. Like, cool. You get like a CMO, or you get like the ads manager, or you get the content creator or the video guy. Like, it's just so many disciplines within the profession. And I think that there's a lot of confusion about what accountants do. Of course, in corporate land, you've got like a whole finance team of like, you know, 20 or 30 people that have different disciplines, but in small business or, you know, anything, any business sub 50 mil, really, it's just, they expect that one guy to be doing everything for them. And it's just not true.
I think the same thing you mentioned happens with marketing as well. Like, you know, people trying to find that unicorn, that person that can do, you know, this and that channel and that channel and that channel. I'm like, that's like seven different jobs, you know? And then, oh, we need help with pricing. We need help with like product development and, you know, new markets and analysis and analytics. And I was just like, yeah, you know, good luck. So I've seen those job descriptions around. So the same thing obviously happens with you, because I know I've been in this situation where I'm like, I went to my accountant and asked them, hey, so, okay, you're following my tax return and everything. You're telling me I need more revenue or reduce expenses, but like, how do I do that? And then it's just like a blank face. And I'm like, how do I get more revenue? And they're like, oh, sales, marketing. And you're like, then it kind of, the conversation stops there. So someone in finance would be more like, looking at Ansoff matrices, maybe you'd have some M&A experience or some ideas around that, thinking strategically about how to double up or
cohort analysis. LTV, like Kate, the stuff that we're probably talking about, like looking at, you know, segmentation of customers, M&A, like all that. Growth oriented things using numbers as the driver, I think is probably the message.
Is there like a massive gap in SMBs then when it comes to accountants? Like, is it just that sort of forward looking side of things that tend to be very retrospective? Or like, you know, before we, let's just say I'm in the market for an accountant, is there something I should know before I go and hire one, or things to look for to make a good decision?
Yeah, it's a really great question. I think that yes, there is a massive gap, and not to say, I'm biased to say that because we're trying to fill the gap in our company. But I think it's on two fronts. There's the accountants who, there is a few things broken in the accounting profession in small business accounting, and this is globally, not just in Australia, where I think accountants are tax people. And most, when you go to the barbecue, yeah, I go, hey, what's your profession? Or you're in the Uber job, like, hey, what's your job? Like, I'm an accountant. They're like, and they just like shut up, or they start asking questions about, oh, you know, I've got this like tax problem, or like, can I claim my petrol, my Uber, all this sort of shit. And I'm like, yeah, they just assume accounts do tax, right? Like, and that's a common misconception. I think that most people assume that in small business particularly, but I think, so there's an education piece that accountants just don't do tax returns. This is the whole thing. But the reality is in small business, most suburban tax accountants and only do tax returns. That's the thing. That's all they do. And I think that there's a learning curve for both for accountants who want to pivot into more finance stuff. They just probably don't have the opportunity to, because they've never done it before. They don't have the experience. Like, I came from a corporate finance background as well as accounting, so I kind of had that exposure. But unless you've worked in that, or worked in commerce or in a larger company, you just don't know what that looks like. And so, obviously you don't want to provide this charge of service for if you have no idea what you're doing, right? Some marketing agencies do that for the accounts.
Yeah, maybe. Well, I think that's the same thing. Like, people go to marketing agencies, which is essentially, they're one of two types. They're like a design agency who just, you know, do brand things and make you look good and pretty pictures and everything. Or there's the sort of media side of agencies, which is just selling you paid media at scale and saying, oh, you got brand awareness and you'll grow. And I think what's missing in the market is that strategic piece, which is everything else, which isn't marcoms or design. You know, it's all the pricing and packaging, the bundling, the systems and processes, you know, the tech that supports it, all that kind of thing. That's the area that I'm trying to plug. But anyway, I digress. On to you. Yeah, this article I was reading recently caught my eye about this clash between the marketing and finance departments. So I really want to get your take on this, because I know that if we know a bit about each other's professions, you can have so much better conversations and a better working relationship that ultimately provides way better outcomes. Why do you think finance and marketing clash so much? This is a general question.
Yeah, I think that firstly, I think there's a lot of, I think personality is a big thing. I think you'll find that a lot of accountants are introverted, kind of, you know, spreadsheet, factual, you know, it's right or wrong, black and white, and because that's mostly what accounting is. Marketing, a bit more fluffy, you're working the gray, a bit more edgy, and I think it attracts, you know, again, stereotyping, but it attracts more, you know, extroverted, creative people. I think that that's a natural clash. You've got the conservative, risk-averse kind of numbers guy who sits behind a cubicle to the creative at what's open plan, post-it notes on the whiteboard, you know, and it's like, so two different personalities and whatnot. I think that the biggest thing though is, getting them to understand each other. I think from an accountant's perspective, you know, accountants or finance people are generally, their role is mainly risk management from a financial perspective. It's like, hey, we've got costs, we've got, we revenue, we need to manage our cash flow. There's things we need to manage. And I think that marketing folks, sometimes you don't have an insight into the inner workings of how business runs in terms of outside of just, you know, revenue, marketing and gross profit, but like there's all these other fixed costs which they don't have any visibility into. And so I think that sometimes there's a disconnect because they don't have insight to that. Vice versa, the accountants, they're not creative most of the time. You don't really want a creative accountant because, you know, you're getting up in trouble sometimes. but yeah, they're not creative in that sense. So they don't really understand like the campaign. Like, well, I don't get it, because quite often they're not really the user. Like, you know, if you're Apple, you're not selling, maybe a bad example, you're not selling Apple computers to finance people. Like, finance people want PCs and Excel, not friggin', you know, I'm a PC guy. I'll never own an Apple because it's not native with Excel. Like, I need Microsoft Office, man. Like, come on. So it doesn't work, right? So it's the same thing. And so they don't get it. And also I think accountants like empathy, which is a separate discussion altogether. But I think marketers, you need to be empathetic to your ultimate users. So big personality clashes. Where the value is if they do talk. And I think that if you can find common ground and work together and share things, particularly around unit economics and LTV and things like that, that's where it can be really powerful.
Okay, interesting. I'll just rattle off a couple of things that I've noticed. Like you mentioned one of them already, which is risk aversion. And a lot of marketing expenditure is inherently risky, but the payoff can be great. You know, so the less risky you are, the marketing, the less effective it really is, because you just start sounding like and doing things like everybody else does. And by virtue, you become undistinctive because you're sounding and looking like everyone else, which works against you. Or you're doing what everyone else is doing and the yield is low because you're competing with everyone else that's doing the same thing. So there's actually a payoff to doing things that are very unconventional and viewed as risky by the same token. So that's one natural thing that I noticed. But there's a couple of others, and I want you to butt in here and give me your take on it, because I wrote a couple of them down. Growing and acquiring customers. So every time I go to finance and go, hey, you know, what's the growth strategy? They always come back with the same thing, which is like M&A, and that's about it. If I ask them about, or they're like, oh, let's take our current product and go to a new market, like market expansion, they tend to be less adept in things like, you know, penetrating the market within the current market or new product development. Those two things generally are viewed as, they either don't understand or inherently risky. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I think you're right in many instances. I think like if you go down to the two alternatives, like product development, it's like, well, great. What are we building here? What's the R&D costs? Like, how many resources are thrown into that? Can we afford that? It's not in the budget to this special one-off spec project, which could be game-changing for the company, but like how many bets do you need to make? I think there's a great book, what's the story of Pixar? It's an amazing...
Is it the Steve Jobs one? Or
When he was running it, but there's a Creative Inc. Basically the journey of Pixar and how they built that business. But the way that Pixar and actually how the entertainment industry works is that you're basically a production factory. You're investing a lot of resources into building a movie or a piece of media, and there's no payoff. You're burning cash flow trying to put your thing, and then you release it to the market and you don't know if it's going to go gangbusters, if it's going to flop. You just don't know. And so for financially, that frightens me as an accountant. It's like, God, you're putting all your eggs in literally Toy Story 1, and like, you better hope it fucking works, man, because dude, we're gonna go bankrupt, and that's almost what happened with Pixar. It's like, you're almost dead if it doesn't pull off. Lucky it did, and then they found the formula to do that. But
you know, sorry to interrupt, but like, that exact risk tolerance permeated the culture in California. And the financiers that financing these big films, obviously, which are inherently risky, like, they learned to work the numbers. So they spread their risk across, 100 different titles. I know one of them is going to make it. And then the sort of the same approach is used in Silicon Valley's funding model by VCs. Yeah. In fact, the people who funded movies became VCs.
Yeah, exactly. That's the concept of angel investors, right? Like, that's how they...
Exactly. The same model from movies. And I think a lot of people don't understand this, but like, that's where it originates. So, anyway, you continue. So that risk sort of aversion, inherent risk aversion, it just comes down to good governance, though. It's like, you have, as a director or a CFO, you have to be like risk adverse, or be really over the have a really good business case and go, okay, maybe there is some risk here, but how do we limit that and how do we get the most of it without like bankrupting the whole company? I mean, that is your responsibility, fiduciary responsibility in your role. So like, I understand that, but at the same time, is there any sort of techniques you would suggest for people to get around that natural sort of pushback?
I think it all comes down to hedging bets. It's like risk management is really placing bets and being calculated about it. So, you know, if we have clients, for example, in a practical sense, we have clients that are looking to invest in this influencer campaign or some sort of pop-up. It's like, cool, how much budget can we allocate that to that so that we don't eat into reserves, or, you know, we've got other channels which are still kind of bringing the money and blue chip kind of streams. And so I wouldn't say, hey, let's just kill all the other channels and go triple down to this speculative thing. Let's hedge bets. So I think it's all about, let's take shots, but let's be smart about it and calculate about it rather than just going all in, which, to be honest, is almost the opposite of how entrepreneurs work. It's like, hey, burn the boats. Like, we're going all in, brother. Like, we're raising the money. We're going double, we're tripling down. Let's build the airplane as we're crashing. And I'm not so on that fence. I'm like, yeah, cool, do that. But like, let's just have some reserve. Let's have a safety net at least. So if it does, if it turns to shit, we've got something to fall back onto.
Yeah, look, I think you raise a good point there. I mean, there's this book called Thinking in Bets by Annie Betts about thinking, probabilistic thinking is generally what the book's about. And it's like taking it from these like one-shot wonders, the visionary CEO who doesn't really make any calculations, to going, okay, I know if I do this enough times or spread my risk this way, something's going to work, but then I'm willing to take losses here and account for that before I sort of go and do that thing. Yeah. And, one risk mitigation thing you can do with NPD is like new product development, is by creating like a little MVP. I hate to use the word, but like, you can trial something or do a pilot test. And at least you turn a hypothesis where you have no data into something which has a bit of data, and then go, actually, this is looking like it may or may not work, and make another decision whether to double down, put more resources into it, and expand it or not. And I found that technique really works, and being real upfront about the risk to finance, I find works as well. So just go, look, we know this works really well, like these channels are producing really well, we want to try this channel. I've allocated 20% of my budget to higher risk sort of return investments. This is one of them. We're going to incorporate this in, you know, what do you think? These are some risk mitigation strategies. You know, after 5 days, it doesn't work, we're going to shut it off or do this, or, you know, whatever. At least that thinking process gives them confidence, I find, to then go, okay, actually, I'll rubber stamp this and I'll sign it off, because, you know, you've at least thought about the downside or potential downside. So that's some things that I've picked up of the and again, this comes back down to business case, right? So you come across these circumstances where, you know, maybe a founder or one of the principals of the business comes to you and go, oh, we were talking to this agency or this person, and they have this really good idea to do, you know, this promotional thing which is going to grow our business. And you sort of have to pull them back a minute and go, oh, why? Like, what's the business case? You know, what are they offering? Do you find yourself having to do that quite a bit?
Quite often. I think, but less so nowadays. I think that a lot of the clients we work with, a lot of our clients are founder-led. We don't really work with typically executives, because I think the demographic of the client base are sub kind of 50 mil revenue businesses where, you know, the founder is the CEO essentially. And so a lot of them are, probably to get them from zero to one, they were that like all in, super, super grown. But then they've realized they tapped out of the ceiling where they couldn't get to
one to two or one to 10 because of lack of operational discipline or execution or whatever. So it's at the beginning, a lot of the entrepreneurial mindset is like, hey, break through brick walls, let's just charge ahead, you know, the hustle, all the Gary Vee stuff. But you get to a stage where you realize that that stops working because there's a million fires and you actually need some, a bit more discipline and operating execution at a different level. And so that's when we usually come in and, you know, and the numbers really kind of drive a lot of that outcome. So fortunately, the founders kind of realized that through realization, like, oh, I've made some mistakes or almost ran out of money and are a little bit, not to say less risk averse, sorry, more risk averse, but they're more calculated in the way they make bets like that. So yes, to answer your question, yes, in some circumstances, but less so now.
Okay. One other thing I noticed as well is, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I'm not an accountant. I don't pretend to be, but by virtue of the job itself is you're looking at getting numbers and putting them into accounts, right? So you're taking little bits of things and categorizing them into categories, and then you're bringing that back into sort of larger bunches of those categories and to create reports, you know, for tax or decision-making processes, right? And sometimes when you do that, it can naturally, because you're pulling apart things and looking at things, dicing and slicing them and looking at things cross-sectionally, you can sometimes easily get into the trap where you don't look at the whole picture because you're separating things out. Example, okay, you're spending on brand things which have a really slow burn effect and non-linear growth effect. So they might do anything for 3 years, but then you, like the content marketing, you know, you'll hit this sort of ramp up where your newsletter ends up getting lots of subscribers all of a sudden. You're like, you know, what happened then? And it wasn't anything that happened immediately then. It was just this culminating effect. So if I was looking at that in year one, I would say, oh, that content marketing is a complete waste of time. Like, it's not doing anything, like, it's not returning. But then if I looked at it at year three and looked at the past 3 years, I'd be going, oh, actually, that's got a positive return now. And then if I looked at it year four, I'm like, that's got a really good return. And, you know, you're not looking at that nonlinear effect over a long time period. So that's just one example. Do you think that's easy to do just by virtue of the profession or?
Yeah, for sure. I know I've fallen into this trap a few times where, you know, we actually lost a client because of this sort of thing. You were this startup kind of real estate agency, consultancy business. And, you know, they had no money, you know, they asked the parents to chip in some cash, like $200K of life savings. And I was like, and they just started burning tens of thousands of dollars in Facebook ads and, you know, engage a content agency. And they were like burning dollars. I'm like, dude, you should be profitable from day one. You're a consultancy. There's no R&D. Like, it's like, God. But then, you know, 18 months later, like, bam, they just found it and the thing worked and now they're crushing it. And, you know, it was all attributed to the work that they did early on. And so I think that, you know, this is again hard with our profession sometimes, because if you're too into the weeds, if you're too into the detail, the books, yeah, you get caught up in that world where you're not piecing the story together until you kind of step back and add context. And I think that's a really important thing about numbers, is that you can kind of present any story you want with data. Like, you really need to add narrative to the information.
Like a false story too.
Exactly. Yeah. It can be fake. Accounting can be super misleading. So you really need to add narrative to what's trying to be achieved. And I think that works in the opposite way as well, where you can manipulate sometimes or stretch the truth. You know, there's a lot of tech companies that have in crazy valuations because they've got this, what's your DCF look like or discounted cash flow? And it's like, oh, well, here's our TAM, you know, here's our estimated users, and you can just make the spreadsheet as magical as you want and to justify whatever price. So I think you realize, and this is what we realize, the difference between kind of immature and mature finance people or accountants, that you can see the difference. You can kind of, you can craft the narrative in the right way, but you can also see through bullshit just through experience.
Yeah, there was this other law as well. I forget what it's called. Well, there's two that are my favorites when it comes to this. But there's this preponderance, there's two biases that people tend to measure the things that are easiest to measure. So coming back to the Facebook example, a lot of, I find this happens, correct me here again if I'm wrong, but like the finance people like to see more direct response marketing investment mechanisms where there's a really clear attribution between expenditure and the return from that expenditure. And they'll tend to favor those over others because there's a more clear relationship and it's easy to measure. And again, The trade-off with that, though, is that it can flick you into using certain channels that have different effects than other channels. An example, you know, you might do Google ads or whatever, or Facebook ads, and the return or ROI looks really good because you're gaining a new customer, you know, for X dollars, and that's like $50 or whatever, and that's like cheap because, you know, you're at least charging $200. But then when you look at the life cycle of the customer, those are the cheap customers that are like churn a lot, and actually the ones that you get from like a channel referral network or, you know, word of mouth are the ones that are really, you know, profitable. So when you look at it two different ways, you're looking at efficiency metric or not, it gives a completely different picture. So I find sometimes if you're doing these, creating these intangible assets, so like reputation or brand reputation, it can look like the money's going nowhere, but in essence, like, boosts everything else up. So there's all this like complexity I find in my area that I'm very conscious of, like appeasing people with very direct relationships, but then also working underneath on these slower burn things that I know are really valuable, but I know that they won't give me budget for because they just don't understand it. So that's the sort of problem that I have a lot of the time. So what do you think about
that? No, you're 100% right. I think the flaw with accounting and accounting standards really is that, yeah, you never recognize intangibles in the balance sheet because you're not allowed to. Like, so no, particularly like internally generated goodwill or whatever. So that just because there's no assets in the balance sheet doesn't mean there's no value in the company. It's because, you know, what you're building is inherently code, essentially, or code and customer base, which are not quantified into a number yet, could be into the future. Yeah. So massive flaw. And I think there's a lot of research about, if you look at the CapEx requirements of, if you look at the S&P 500 and over time, if you look at the asset heavy industries, back in the, you know, in the industrial era, was like, you know, to build a big business, you need lots of plant machinery, you need equipment, all that sort of stuff. Nowadays, it's all the valuable companies are in technology or digital assets. And so the CapEx recognized in the balance sheet is declining over time, oppositely correlated with value, because a lot of the value is in data, basically. So inherent flaw with accounting. And that's why sometimes the financial statements themselves are also deceiving because of accounting quirks.
Well, hopefully that gives some people a better idea of like maybe how to work better with the mindset of the two professions. I find myself sort of merging more into finance, and it sounds like you like worked in accounting and then emerging more into marketing and more into like the consulting piece as well, where you're looking at the whole picture. But what do you think are the hallmarks of, let's just say I'm trying to find a really good finance or accountant to help me with my business, you know, specifically around growth or, you know, the analysis to then make better decisions to grow the business. What do you think are the hallmarks someone who's quite junior or green in that field versus someone who is more senior, more experienced, and perhaps better value to pay their high rate?
Yeah, I think that this probably applies to all professions. Is, you know, the professional will always tell you what they don't know. They're always qualified. They're like, yeah, I know this, but I'll quickly tell you I don't know anything else outside this domain, or like, and so I can't help you with that. They're very definitive. Where I think some of the more junior, maybe hungrier, will say yes to more things and try to overreach on their expertise, and they quickly found out if they're saying yes to many things, you just start to put stringly alarm bells, because you can't be everything to everyone, which is the truth.
And obviously you mentioned this in another podcast, you say it depends a lot. So when someone asks you a question, well, what's the secret to growth? And I want to ask you this in a second, you probably go, well, it depends, you know, what you want to achieve. It's like this Dunning-Kruger effect. It's like you come across as like less confident in your answer, exactly. But essentially that is the hallmark of someone who's very good at what they do. And the same people, they ask me, hey, what's the secret to growth? I'm like, well, that's a big complex question. Like, and I always answer the same way. I go, well, the secret to growth is believing there's not one thing that is the secret to growth in the first place. Nice. So like, that's a bad question to answer. But yeah, over to you. Do you think that's true as well? Or?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's the Dunning-Kruger effect is an amazing phenomenon, and so true in many ways, that the more you learn, the less you know, unless you're confident in your ability. And you just kind of remind yourself, oh, no, you do know enough, but you just realize how much you don't know as well. So it's
what do you think though are the biggest barriers for effective financial management for a company? So what numbers should we be really over? You know, is there something that's really core and essential we have to know, and then some other things that are like nice to haves but less essential? And I know you've got this in your book, but maybe just a quick overview.
I think it all stakeholders in the business should be across. Everyone talks about, you know, profit in things like that, and that's usually the metric that everyone looks at. I actually think gross profit, which is above their profit. So for those kind of new to the financial world, there's revenue, which is your sales money coming in. And then you've got like cost of sales, which are the expenses associated with selling what your product is. And then there's like your other costs like CAC and rent and wages. And so gross profit is your revenue less all your variable kind of cost of sales. Gross profit to me is the most important metric in any business, because it helps understand how much variable income my business makes as I grow. So for example, I like to say that revenue is a vanity metric in many instances, because you compare $1 with a dollar, they're not always the same, because $1 in a SaaS business is very different to $1 in a e-commerce business, because the margin generated from an e-commerce business might only be 40% gross margin. Versus the SaaS business might be 90%. So the SaaS business gets 90 cents of profit or gross profit for every dollar that they sell. E-commerce business only gets 40 cents. And so there's a big, obviously a SaaS business has better economics. So gross margin is a big one. And also cash flow. I know that everyone talks about cash being king and things like that, but it truly is. And profit can be deceiving in many ways, because it isn't always the same as cash.
Yeah, it's interesting because you know, when it comes to investing in more things to get more cash and more revenue, I find if I don't have cash available, I can't invest in those things. Yeah. Or I think about, do I raise debt? And then there's more scrutiny on that. If I have the cash available, I can make a faster decision and I can act faster than I could if I had to, like, you know, raise capital or get debt funded. Yeah, I find it gives me more options to have cash. It makes me respond quicker to problems that I have or shortfalls and things like that. So, you know, I find it's more flexible and you can more agile as a business.
Definitely true. I think that the best businesses we like are businesses with what we call like a negative cash cycle. So basically Amazon, you might have an unprofitable business or a business with very low margins, but if they've got a cash cycle which is favorable to the business in the sense that they have very favorable terms where they get paid up front, but they might have to pay their suppliers for 60 or 90 days. They're holding cash, which can be then reinvested back into the growth. And so, cash flow in that instance is better than looking at profit. And Amazon actually is one of the greatest examples of that, where, you know, early in the days when they weren't profitable, they had very low margins and they were barely breaking even, but they had a really favorable cash conversion cycle. So they were cash flow, they were cash flow rich, but margin poor, which allowed them to reinvest back dollars back into market share and things like that.
Which they've consistently done over the years still, like to this day, they're just investing heaps in the distribution network now. Yeah. Obviously, you know, that's a big part of the business. And obviously that limits the tax that you have to pay to an extent on your earnings. So, it's really interesting. As long as you're using that cash to generate more cash.
Exactly. The key thing. Exactly right.
If you're using it just to like piss off some ads that are like fluffy that didn't do anything, you know, that's a bad use of money.
Yeah, I mean, you need to put the money to work in the right ways, you know, not just burning it.
One thing I wanted to ask you about on metrics is ROI, because I think it's one of, personally, I want to hear what you think, but a lot of the time people go, let's hire a marketing agency, whatever. What's the ROI on that channel? What's the ROI on that expenditure? What's the ROI on that? Or ROAS, which is return on advertising spend, which is like the fluffiest metric I've ever seen. But what do you think about those two sort of common agency sort of metrics there?
Yeah, I hate them. And I know that sounds probably weird coming from an accountant who would always want to measure everything, right? Like, yeah, I think it's almost like the opposite. And to me, that used to be me until I realized you start probably being more clued on and learning how things are tracked and measured. You realize it's all made up. Like, ROAS was never really accurate ever. And like the whole thing of attribution, I mean, like we can go down a rabbit hole of that if you wanted to, but it's like, yeah, it's just made up. So I think, well, in terms of ROI, I think now that learning more about marketing and working with our clients who are very marketing focused, you know, you appreciate that. Yeah, I mean, like there's bets that we need to make, and you know, it's a content thing, and we can't quantify everything because you can't attribute everything, and nor should you, I think. You know, there's multi touch points in every brand and relationship that you have, and it's really hard to measure and track. But you should allocate a budget to it, right? And I think it comes back to the numbers. Is like, well, that's cool. How we think about like ROI of marketing is, and particularly like e-commerce brands, for example, you know, like you look at MER or, you know, marketing or media efficiency ratio, you look at, well, how much are you spending versus what is the revenue? And so long as that percent is within the bucket of what we've allocated as a budget, which means, and we set that budget based on profit goals or cash flow goals to make sure we can still turn the engine, that's okay. So however you spend that budget is up to you. You know, that's up to the marketing team and how you guys do it. But so long as we are within that kind of those rails, we're all good, basically. So that's how we think about it, because we do acknowledge that marketing is an investment. And like all good things, it takes time.
Yeah, cool. That's interesting, the rail concept. I like that. I think that'd be really useful for some people who are listening. So with that said, I mean, you've got some really good things in your book. In the growth side of things, there is this preponderance to use like a North Star metric or a North Star growth metric. So when you're growing a business, you figure out, especially in SaaS, this is quite popular, like, is it high margin customer acquisition, you know, or is it GMV, gross merchandise value? Like, that's your main metric you're trying to optimize for. And there's a lot of, you know, trade-offs here with which one you choose. There's two arguments. One is that there is such thing as one metric that rules them all. And there's the other side, which is like, well, actually, you might have one as a target in a period of time, depending on what strategy you're doing currently. But then there's all these other ones you really got to be over as well, which contribute to that one. What's your take on that?
Yeah, it depends. Yeah, it depends. depends on the business model, depends on the strategy of the business. It really does depend. I think that if you're looking for scale and growth, the growth at all costs, it's like GMV is the biggest thing. Like the Ubers of the world, Airbnb, they probably look at purely GMV. It's like how much dollars are being transacted through our platform, and that's the North Star metric. I think for a small business owner, it might be just like net profit. It's like, how much profit am I making per month for the thing? So it really does depend. I'm always of the approach of trying to add a few. Like we have so SBO, our company, we have our North Star is ARPA or ARPU. So it's like how much revenue per customer per month, right? And so if we can grow that, knowing that our margins are what they should be based on our pricing, we should build a pretty good and solid business. So that's our approach, but it needs to be balanced with some more qualitative metrics sometimes. And it's just like the McKinsey nerds or the, you know, the typical strat people say, you need like a balanced scorecard where you're not just looking at the financials, we need to look at like customer service and all these other things, which is true, but you can get too obsessive about measuring too many things about your business. So yeah, I think you pick 1 to 3 and just focus on those. And yeah, but to answer your question, it really depends on what you're trying to do with your business.
Okay. What about misconceptions here? So what's the major one that people believe about accounting, or, you know, your discipline of finance and accounting, but which you know to be false?
I think that people think accountants are really good at math. So like adding things up, and, you know, when you're at the dinner table with a group of friends and we have to split the bill, they're always like, look to the accountants like, hey, how much do we owe? It's like, dude, I don't freaking know. Like everyone thinks that, yeah. It's accountants fail without a spreadsheet or a calculator. Like just to say that most of my friends are accountants and they all suck at math equally as I do. So numbers people conceptually, but when it comes down to like quick math, fail miserably.
I love it. It's like sometimes people come into marketing, people are like, hey, sell me this thing. You're like, yes. I'm not in sales. Like, what are you talking about? Exactly. And then some people are pretty good at it, but most people kind of suck.
Yeah.
They're like, no, I don't do that. So yeah, that's funny. Okay, what about some routine mistakes people make that you see time and time again in business when it comes to the numbers?
Yeah, I think that from a business owner's perspective, I think like not doing bookkeeping as basic or stupid, as simple as it sounds. Like we have seen so many crises that could have been avoided with just like simple getting a bookkeeper or just spending an hour a week just getting the books done yourself. Because frankly, if you don't have visibility on your financials just through getting some information to an accounting system, you really have no idea how you're performing. And I think that, so that's fundamental. I know it sounds bleep in many ways, but it's just true. Just get the basics done and that you're almost set up for success from there.
Okay. I love it. So do bookkeeping on time.
I'll pay someone. Yeah, I'll get bookkeeper. One of the two. Yeah, just get it done.
Okay, I love it. What about anything that's really funny, memorable, or random, or moments of success that you've had in your career that you've experienced that you'd want to tell other people about?
I'm trying to think of a good one. I think that, I think there's definitely been some like great stories of working with clients. I mean, our clients we work with, they're entrepreneurs, they're founder-led businesses, they're all got like crazy and wacky ideas. But I think there's some, but all of them, one intrinsic driver of all of them is that, you know, they say that money doesn't equal happiness. It's like, that's not untrue. Like, you know, it's certainly...
People with too much money, you say that.
Exactly. I think there's, you know, that study you've read where it's like, and if you earn more than like $80,000 or $75,000 of income, it doesn't have the same utility as someone with $200,000. I think that's bullshit. Like, you know, some of the, if you show, you report the numbers to some founders who are reporting like really great profit and cash flow, they're super happy. Like, it's always fun delivering great news. You never want to deliver bad news, and we're the same. You know, we want to see great results. And so, I think a personal satisfaction that we get with our job is we get to help people like really realize their financial goals. Like, and it sounds, again, cliche, but you know, helping founders use their business as a wealth creation vehicle. It's, you know, there's no better asset class than small business, I think, you know. You know, really seeing the founders and the people you work with really drive towards a result and realize that cash in their bank account so they can pay off the mortgage or put the kids through private schools or whatever they want to do with the money is really personally satisfying.
No, I love it. I mean, I've noticed the same. When I'm down, my business is generally doing bad. When I'm up, it's doing well, and I'm cash rich. I'm like, yeah,
yeah.
So it's kind of symptomatic of, you know, economic recessions and stuff. I understand that now why it's called a depression, because it's true.
Yeah, it's so true.
Yeah. And last thing is, what do you think some of the things you thought would work in your business when you're growing it, but actually end up failing? You know, so. Maybe some disconnect there between what you thought would work and what didn't.
Yeah, in my own business.
Yeah,
really good question. I think that...
Or that you observe in other people's businesses.
Yeah, it's a good question. So what I think the funnest... So when most people think about accountants, they think about like tight ass cost cutting. So when like you speak to your accountant about like, hey, I'm not making as much money as I thought. How do I improve my profit, right? And the default response by most kind of accounts is like, oh, you're going to reduce your costs. Like, it's obvious, right? Yeah. So you go through your line by line item in your expense account. You're like, huh, what's this? Huh, that's $10. You don't need that. What's this thing? You don't need that. And you're just like, and it's a very like penny-pinching mentality. And I think that's probably the stereotype of many accountants. It's like you're tight ass penny pinching people, and
that's
saw
what mine does, but they always go to my travel and
entertainment buckets, like, exactly.
Yeah, it's always that one that they pick first.
Where's Christmas office Christmas party? Get rid of that shit. You don't need that. Coffee. And then I was as an employee of my old firm is during the GFC. I saw firsthand as a benefactor of being on the end of that. So worked for an accounting firm. I won't mention who they were, but you can check out my LinkedIn. You'll probably piece it together. Very global, large accounting firm. GFC hit. You know, clients were exposed, and you know, everyone's talking about cost cutting and whatnot. And so, what happened? They started the coffee machine they had in the kitchen was just suddenly removed, and so they replaced it with instant coffee. And you know, the stationery cabinet where people would pile up and stockpile on pens and biros, that suddenly had a lock. On it, and a register where if you wanted to get a new notepad, you had to go and kind of ask the gatekeeper of stationery to, can I have a new notepad and a pen? Like, really tight ass stuff. And they canceled the Christmas party, or they made it really, a Melbourne Cup function was, and it sounds really dumb in hindsight, but it's just these small things where you work your ass off for a company, you see the penny pinching behavior. It really destroys morale, and you can see it stuff, you know, it churn increase because people are pissed off. And it creates a negative environment and actually has an adverse impact to what the behaviors that we're trying to create of trying to improve the bottom line. If half of your most valuable staff leave because of stupid policies by head office, well, then you've lost half the value of your company anyway. So it was all for vanity.
That's great. Okay. Well, look, I've got some standard questions that I ask everyone at the end. I know I always ask people, you know, what book are you reading now that you really recommend people read or have read in the past that, you know, was essential to, you know, on this topic about growth and using finance and numbers for that? Obviously, I just want to mention your book again. It's really interesting, Stark Naked Numbers by yours truly. Any other book that you'd recommend people read?
When it comes to finance and accounting, I think there's a really good book. It's referenced a lot by entrepreneurs. It's called Profit First by Mark McCallowitz. And I'm sure, you know, John, you've heard of it. Probably many of your listeners have. That book was, it's not really an accounting book. It's more about like how to think about cash flow management for your small business. And it was actually really eye-opening for myself as an accountant, not because I didn't understand what was happening, but it actually added just a new perspective and the empathy of how business owners think about money and cash flow and their business. And yeah, very pivotal kind of moment when I read it. I was like, oh, wow, this is how they think about it. Like, that's so different to how I think about things. And it helped, again, that level of empathy, which was really powerful to make you a better person and an advisor in the end.
Well, that's great. Okay. And what about favorite website resources? That's like your go-to website. For doing your job, is there some sort of like hidden blog or, you know, idea repository or super spreadsheet that's online that's free or something that you'd recommend yeah, people use? Or?
Yeah, great question. I love FinTwit and Twitter. I don't actively use Twitter, but I follow like the finance kind of sub, all the finance people on Twitter. There's a few folks like Aswath Damodaran, who's like the Yoda of valuations and finance. Like there's like professors. Daniel McCarthy, I think you've had on the podcast,
yes,
as well. Yeah, like yeah, guys like him, yeah. Like just following folks on social media, dropping really great, like deep, insightful content in the realm of finance and business is great. It's just free information, which is amazing by experts.
I love the finance meme accounts as well. They're some of my favorite.
So
I found a really good one. It was like it's an Aussie one actually. It has lots of eights in it.
Triple eight account or something.
It's hilarious. And there's the Goldman Sachs elevator. I really like that one. There's so many good ones. And they provide a lot of insight. Like they're kind of like sarcastic in a way, but also I think they provide the story that isn't in the media that people can't talk about, which actually improves your analysis and you become a bit more skeptical. And I think when you're looking at things now and don't take it at face value. So that's why I think they have value.
Oh, for sure.
They're hilarious.
I think like sarcasm is the highest form of intelligence or something like that. Wit is the highest form of intelligence.
Yeah.
It's like memes are just gold. Like memes are, they're so clever and they're so stupid, but like in the right context, like, oh, there's so many truths in the meme, but also hilarious. Yeah, I love it.
Well, actually, that was one of my next questions. Is like, is there a quote or meme about, you know, this topic we're discussing, which makes you laugh every time, or, you know, is a sort of mantra that you use?
No particular meme. No particular one meme, but I love memes. But I think there's a common saying that we always kind of say and preach, and also in the book, that there's a passage. I don't know who said it. I think it's been incorrectly said by Warren Buffett or someone, but I don't think it's true. Anyway, it's like revenue is vanity, profit is sanity, but cash is reality. And I think that's true. It's honest and applies to every scenario. That's revenue is a vanity metric, as we always talk about. Cash flow is always the thing that matters the most in the end.
Okay, and what about a piece of tech you can't do without that helps you do your job? Excel or?
yeah, literally. Google Sheets. We're mostly on Sheets nowadays. Google Sheets, and Slack.
It keeps getting better too. Like they keep adding more and more features. You notice a lot of stuff was like manual. You had to code it, you know, for a lot of functions in Excel that were just like default. You're like, why do I have to put my own code in this custom code thing? And then they use it as a test mechanism to see how many people actually use it, and then they'll roll out that feature and you'll notice it gets better and better and better.
Google Sheets, definitely.
I'm loving Data Studio for analysis and visualization and hooking Google Sheet data into that.
Yeah.
Because obviously they're both owned by the same companies. There's a natural integration. And I'm finding the sheet analysis, and then I make it look pretty for people who, you know, are maybe less analytical and more visual people. And I find that really a good technique for lots of things.
Right.
Yeah, I want to get some analysis. Anyway, okay, that's great. And what about a plug? You know, obviously you've got your book, SBO Financial, but what's your pitch to people in case people are listening and then they're in the sort of hitting zone? What can you do for businesses?
Yeah, well, if you guys, anyone that's interested in improving their financial literacy, understanding, just getting a better understanding of their business finances. So this is not personal financial advice, it's all about business, profit, cash flow, margins, all that sort of stuff. We create a lot of free content. Probably best to follow me on LinkedIn, where you can find me, just search Jason Andrew. We have an accounting firm, but that services kind of high growth digital businesses. I got the book, and we also developed a course, which is same name as the book, Stark Naked Numbers, which is a foundational program for founders to really help them understand financial management. So it's the folks that, when you start a business, you don't really learn about numbers. You're just like, crap, I've got to start a business now. I've got payroll, I've got rent, and I've got bills and things. And no one really teaches you, here's how you should run the finances of your business. So it's kind of a $200 course, which self-paced learning, lots of videos and spreadsheets and things for you to kind of just take control of your business finances in a simple way.
That's great. And how do we find that? Is that on the link in your website, or is that Coursera or something like that? Or?
Just jump on starknakednumbers.com, which is the website, okay. And you'll find you can buy the book and the course and things like that over on that website.
Perfect. Hey, well, and obviously if people want to contact you, probably best on LinkedIn or going to your website, filling a contact form or something like that.
Yeah, just send me a DM and on LinkedIn is easy. Yeah. Okay.
Nice. Hey, well, I want to thank you for your time. I know you're a busy man. I'm really liking your content. That's how I found out about you. So really want to ask you some of those questions. Thanks for your time, and hopefully we'll talk again soon.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, John. And this is great.
Thanks. Cheers.
Thanks, everyone. See ya.
That was an episode I've been wanting to do for a while, because great marketing and growth initiatives live or die by their financials. So it was great to hear how we can increase our chances of getting things we know will work approved by finance. And this episode loosely fits under the measurement strategy area, but also flows nicely into the objective setting portion of the strategic process, which relates to all initiatives. And we have one more guest from a very large business in the US who will fill in the gaps from more, I would call a campaign measurement analytical perspective, which is coming up soon. The next episode also touches a little on data and a little under the guise of segmentation and targeting strategy. So by now, we've covered nearly all 9 areas of growth strategy: promotions, media, messaging, segmentation, targeting, positioning, product, pricing, measurement, with just data, sales, and distribution to go. Up next, we also have more growth levers or channels or mediums or whatever you want to call them. M&A is next, and there's 40 or so others which will follow, plus a smattering of personal exposés into the life of real-life practitioners. Big names, small names, but everyone knows their craft back to front. So lots of work to go, and thanks again for following. As always, if you have any feedback or comments, make sure you DM me on LinkedIn or tag me on Twitter. A Dose of John is my Twitter handle, or look for John James on LinkedIn, the guy from Melbourne in a blue t-shirt. Otherwise, you can find me on Instagram under Champagne Society. Remember to give a follow to receive notifications on your podcast listening app. Otherwise, I'll be uploading the full episodes on YouTube in the coming weeks. So that's all for now. Thanks for listening.